Red Hat X podcast series, discussing topics around application modernization, cloud-native development, securing workloads in the cloud, and partnering with Red Hat. Thank you so much for joining us today. My name is Brian. It's another Tech Talk episode on the Red Hat X podcast series. And today I am here once again with John Aaron, founder and CEO of Aaronetics, and Jared Brennan, founder and principal consultant of Brennan Consulting. Today we're going to be discussing counterpoints to advertised truths. This is going to be a very fascinating discussion today, as we're going to be talking about some of the action steps that we can take from a short-term perspective and also from a long-term perspective. Get ready for this. We're diving in, and we're diving in deep. John, Jared, welcome back. Great to have you both once again here on the show. Thank you.
Thanks,
Brad. You're very welcome.
Yeah, I'm glad we get to chat and have fun again. But I got to know, well, first of all, just a quick refresher of who you are and what you do. So John, you go first, and then Jared, follow right up.
I'm John Aaron, and I built Aaronetics, currently an Ohio company, and we see edges everywhere, and I'm walking around scared lately. So when I walk into my local coffee shop, I'm like, I don't want to connect to your Wi-Fi. I didn't want to park my car in your parking lot, but I have to get coffee, right?
So yeah. Okay, so you're walking around scared. So we'll talk about how to maybe alleviate some of that today.
Does that sound good? Thank you.
I like that. Jared.
Yeah, Jared Brennan, Brennan Consulting. I am a music teacher turned hacker turned graybeard virtual CISO. Doing a lot of fractional CISO work through Side Channel, one of my partner companies, and talking to folks like John on the regular about all the changes that we're living through right now in the tech space.
Yes, and we will touch on those today too, so I appreciate you saying that. So what are you guys currently nerding out on? Or, you know, because I mean, we've shared a little bit, but what's new?
Well, I think, Brian, today's unique that in prior conversations, I have yet to buy anything to support your other podcasts, but this podcast is being recorded on top of a cannonball.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So how did you get that?
Stumbled on this cannonball as a pirating opportunity in Ioannina, Greece, at the old castle that's there. And if any Greek listeners want the cannonball back, there's a conversation that is able to happen about that. But currently, it's on my desk as an ornament.
That's awesome. How heavy do you think that thing is? I'm curious.
It's a legit cannonball. It's definitely two hands to pick it up at length.
Okay.
So I'm going to say it's probably like 30 pounds.
All right. Very nice. Like
50K. It's stretched a leather purse on the way out. So
quick, put this in your purse. Is that kind of how it went down?
Kind of, yes.
So wait,
while we're there.
Yeah, that's awesome. So I was thinking that, you know, your 20s, you know, when you were pirating out in the Caribbean, because like, you know, Jared talked about music teacher originally. So you were like a pirate and then now Aaronetics founder.
That's a very accurate way to state that. Okay. My history usually astounds individuals where I have a large scope and depth. So we could definitely entertain that I've been requested to be a thought leader, a subject matter expert for USOCOM.
Oh, very nice. Very nice. All right. Jared, what about you, man?
I spend most of the day helping folks build security programs from the ground up, which isn't so much nerding out as kind of taking all the stuff that I do and stepping back and what's step one, step two, step three. But I do have a company I'm working with where we are going down a couple of paths. One of the problems we're trying to solve is the gap between the number of people working in cybersecurity, the number of open positions, and the number of people who want to work in cybersecurity and just don't have a clear path. I know there are a lot of folks working on that same problem, and I like the approach that the folks I'm working with are taking. So more on that eventually. I want to wait until we've got something more concrete to share.
Sure.
And then in the Web3 space, which John told me right before we started talking today, I think it was Stephen Diel's article, John, in 2600. Mm-hmm. And for the sake of language, Brian, I won't include the name of the article, but Stephen doesn't have the best opinion of Web3. And I am going to give that article a read. It's out on his blog because I'm definitely interested in that perspective. But I'm also working with that same company on a blockchain-based supply chain management solution, understanding that smart contract functionality in the supply chain and just some of the more completeness, an understanding of where inventory is, what are the attributes of that inventory. So much potential to change supply chain processes for the better. We're working to build a solution that can help companies do just that.
Very nice. All right. So the title of the episode today is Counterpoints to Advertise Truths. Talk about what that means and what's going through your minds on this.
Well, if I may, when I, for at least, I don't really watch television too much. I don't know if you do, Jared or Brian, but when I see a NordVPN or any other provider, I'm like, oh dear,
yeah.
Who's actually watching this? Who is actually remaining more secure? And not labeling that one company, but there's many other companies out there too. I had a meeting with a legal advisor recently that shared one of his legal advisors, this company that supports law firms, became a cybersecurity company because there's money to be made, which we don't disagree that there is a problem, but it's to recognize the entire posture change we need to have.
Wait, so are you saying that in these companies, and you know, not necessarily naming out or calling out specific companies per se, but are you saying that they're putting the money above the actual help that they're offering?
Absolutely, yes. Absolutely.
So they're essentially preying on fear versus saying, hey, this is an actual legitimate thing to protect you and you need this. It's more of a, oh, we're just going to make you kind of scared and you know, you'll pay us a lot of money. I mean, is that kind of what you're saying?
In a nutshell, basically, Okay. Yes.
So I will point out that John and I are not in the same room, so we're not going to come to fisticuffs over this, but
totally accurate.
We do have slightly different perspectives on this, John. You know, I look at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I've been a supporting member for years. Highly recommend listeners of this podcast go to EFF.org and take a look at what they're all about, because they are a brilliant organization doing amazing work. And, you know, they provide guidance to people who are in countries that have limited access to internet resources, who, if you're in the middle of a political protest or a situation where your life might be in danger as someone offering an unpopular opinion with the people you're surrounded by. The EFF provides a lot of guidance for people on how they can have access to information and how they can express those opinions without putting themselves at a risk of having their privacy invaded. And, you know, they have some guidance around VPN solution providers, and they let you know what their thoughts are based on who they've evaluated. And, you know, like you said, Brian, not calling out names, I will look at, you know, Nord, Proton. There were a couple of VPN providers who made a decision recently based on one of the policies coming from the Indian government to say, look, if we have to turn this information over, we're just going to pull out of your country, which, you know, I'm not going to get political here. I will say that does have a negative impact on the people in the country who are trying to access these services. But they're saying, we are so committed to doing this privacy thing right that we're willing to walk away from money. We're willing to walk away from subscribers unless you, as a government, change your policy that in a way that doesn't put your people at risk. So, and all of that underlies, you know, without getting into financial philosophies, I am an advocate of, you know, fair pay for fair work. So if somebody's developed a technology that gives a reporter the ability to interview somebody in a country under an oppressive regime, I think it's fair for that technology provider to be compensated for that technology. But, you know, to John's point, when you cross that line as a company and you embrace the fear, uncertainty, and doubt and start manipulating your potential customers, you're crossing a line there, folks. That's an ethical territory that I don't like to see companies slip into.
It's the same thing that I agree, Jared, that F does a lot of great things. And they do a lot of great things around the world. But the privacy of DNS, the privacy of your VPN, the privacy of your operating system. I recently reviewed the video on a country next to Russia who has a president who's a very happy and likes to be named the last dictator. scratch your head on that, but there's no privacy in that country. Hmm. And it's, there's, with flaws in hardware and software, you should be able to use your computer in your own house the way you want to. And there's maybe limits on that, right? Mm-hmm. Of what you can and cannot actually do on the dirty internet.
I like the way you put that, John, the dirty internet. That's a, no, it's a good description. It, you know, I'll call back to Cory Doctorow, his book, Makers, right? If anybody's read Little Brother, anybody follows Boing Boing, Doctor is a futurist and has some really insightful blogs and essays and narrative fiction around where he thinks we're headed. And I remember reading Makers years ago and just being fascinated by this notion of the freedom that comes as these technology changes are happening, that we can do just that, John. We should be able to use these technologies in a way that doesn't expose our personal information, that doesn't expose us to ads for things that we don't need.
Yeah.
And in a lot of cases don't even want. And we're getting there. We're not there today, but we're getting there. And there's a lot of progress being made in that space.
Right. Could you imagine if everyone had an ad blocker in their home router, what the advertising budgets would be worldwide?
I saw somebody talk about the changes. I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. And I had somebody chime in on an article where, you look at Google and Apple and some of the privacy changes they're implementing that are reducing the amount of data that advertisers have access to. And mm-hmm. this person's argument was that, can you imagine what it would mean to pay for all these free apps that we use that are currently being funded by advertising revenue? I'm struggling with that because from a financial perspective, as somebody who tries to keep up with different streaming services, because I do watch, I'm a movie guy, television guy, story is everything to me.
Me too.
I know how awful it is to try to pay for multiple streaming services each month.
Yeah.
And when I look at the mobile app space, if everything was 99 cents, $5, $20, then there's a lot of apps that people just wouldn't use because you can only afford so much. Mm-hmm. But this notion that, well, yeah, it's okay to trade my private data so that I can have access to that for free, I think is a fundamentally broken way of thinking. Hmm. And I'm saying that as a privacy advocate, but I can't get behind that approach to say, no, we should keep opening the kimono and just give away everything because I get to save 99 cents on my next Angry Birds app. I can't get behind it.
So what do you think's actually happen? I mean, let me put it this way: what's a worst case scenario with that approach? At least, what do you think?
How heavy do you want to get, Brian?
Bring it. No, really. I'm curious what your thought is on that.
So if you look at the history of GDPR in the EU, and mm-hmm. you look at the definition of privacy language in the EU as compared to a country like the United States, one of the key reasons for their strict approach to privacy was the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. Because when you have too much information available about yourself that's readily available to people who can't be trusted to act responsibly with that information, in a situation where we saw in Europe where someone comes to power and decides that they want to commit genocide against an entire group of people,
yeah,
access to that information and the resources available to enact their madman plans with force result in one of the biggest atrocities of human history.
Yeah.
And that's, like I said, that's Jared coming full on, right? You didn't know that's where we're going today, but hey,
no,
here we are.
No, I appreciate that. And I wanted to hear, like, what do you think a worst case scenario is? And, you know, I think that, and this is something that I think we all notice, is that it's the frog in the boiling water.
Oh yeah.
We don't notice what's going on around us because it's happening so slowly. But then when it happens, it's like, oop, too late. Didn't see it coming.
Yeah.
That's definitely it throws me back to a Latin phrase I've known of for 20 years now. Orbis tenio lupum. When the general was crossing the Tiberius. And it's, what are you going to do here? Holding that wolf by the ears. Hmm. If you let go, it's going to bite you.
Yeah.
But, so you can't let go, but it's a wolf.
Yeah.
So
that's good.
How do you actually, we have to like redesign the whole, we made the internet and it's now 70 years old about. privacy and DNS privacy and VPN VPNs didn't even exist back then. Mm-hmm. And so we have people making security products to the old way of thinking. And so we need to change the way we think.
Yes. Yeah, I can get behind that, John. There. Now if we were in the same room, I'd shake hands.
Yeah, we can. Yeah.
Big hug.
Yeah. By and large, yes, I can definitely embrace open source software and the roots of Debian, the roots of Slackware, the roots of Red Hat, the roots of Minix before all those three became a thing. Mm-hmm. Versus the now adoption by open source software from Microsoft, which is just weird to people like me that just see that in a different light.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you mentioned we need to change the way we think, but then what's next? What are the steps that, you know, we need to take individually and collectively as well?
Like Jared mentioned, what if we had full DNS privacy everywhere? What if we told this country in Europe, not part of the EU, that, hey, you're behaving badly. We turned off your pipe to the internet because you already have autocrats taking control of their people. Why don't we have the people organically and the IETF saying, hey, we're now on behalf of, dare I say, NATO, that can actually embrace turning off your pipe to the internet until you can behave appropriately. That the evolution of privacy, like the GDPR with DNS privacy, the right to be forgotten.
Yeah, so that's... Boy, I thought I was getting heavy. And here John comes in laying it down. I like that, John, the notion that we have expectations that people will meet a certain criteria, right? That you must be this tall to ride. Only you must be this private to engage. There is a risk, I think, that comes with we'll just shut you off. There are people who... Mm-hmm. I think would be negatively impacted because of the policies of people that they don't want, that they disagree with. But if they're bound by a political system that doesn't give them that voice or that doesn't reflect some of the goals that maybe the majority of the people in that country share, then that could backfire. I struggle with the short game versus the long game challenge, because I think what you're talking about right now is short game, right? Is tactical. It's the same thing when we look at crime and we say, well, we need the police force to come in and respond to crime. Yeah, that's a crucial component of any society. But we also need to focus on prevention. We don't need to just be in a permanent response capability, where we say, oh, you did a bad thing, now we're going to take action. But, you know, we ask the five whys. We keep digging until we get to the root of the issue and then say, okay, this is why the bad thing is happening. And so let's see what we can do at the front end. If I look at Web3, and you know, anybody who follows Jack Dorsey saw his notes about Web5, right? Which, you know, I can't even keep up. Where'd Web4 go? What are we doing jumping into Web5 already? You know, there's if you go out to tbd.website, you can see some of Jack's thinking on this right now and starting to put together a sort of framework for this idea of decentralization. Which again, Stephen Deal, if you're listening, I am going to read your article. But this notion that that we take technology that resides in the hands of people who are making sweeping decisions for everybody else and say, no, let's step back. Let's give people the ability to stand up their own nodes, to build their own networks, to create their own community and, you know, see where that goes. There's a lot to decentralization that just to me, the underlying concept of the democratization of the internet that I think helps solve some of these privacy problems.
Yeah.
Well, at the same time, introducing the risk of some of the worst echo chambers we have seen in human history.
Right.
If I'm only in a network of people who all share my views and I'm in an extremist community, which I'm not, I just need to say that for the podcast. But boy, that there are risks there that we have to manage as well. But that's the path I recommend we focus on is decentralization.
I appreciate what you're saying too about the long-term versus short-term thing too. And I think, you know, every industry faces this somewhere, somehow. And, you know, a few people stand up and say, hey, we got to do something about this. And it takes either a very, very long time or it never really happens because, you know, it's hard to get everybody on board. But you're right. Yeah. You know, the short term, it's like you're talking about the symptoms. But then mm-hmm. the long term, essentially, you're talking about the root cause. Yes. And the root cause is what I mean, this isn't anything, though. I mean, you brought up the police force and stuff, and I'm not going to get into debating yeah. gun violence at all, but guns right. are a symptom, but the root cause is the person behind the gun in the first place, you know? And yeah. so they both need to be addressed, you know, in some way or another, but it's a longer term thing to work on the psyche of someone, you know? And it's the same kind of thing here. It's a very long term to fix this problem, but the short term is, okay, so what can we do in the meantime to put a Band-Aid on it while we're working on the long, you know, the long term?
Yeah.
Right. We need pretty powerful Band-Aids. I agree with Jared and myself, Brian, that some of my ideas, early short Band-Aids, having an IETF NATO branch, an idea of that.
Yeah.
But it really is, if you have EFF doing the excellent stuff that they do, and then you have supporting your end user, what expectation of privacy do you have in your own house? We could go down the rabbit hole of at least the US Supreme Court on that, but.
Hey, real quick. Hey, Alexa, play Despacito. There. I want to see how many folks listening just had an abrupt reminder of the privacy implications of what's listening in their house.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Hey, wait, I have a quick question. Sorry, not to interrupt your thought, but going back to the VPN kind of thing, do you think that they're doing the Band-Aid thing? Are they actually helping from the short term? Or are they actually contributing more to the problem, though?
I think they're doing both short term and making more of a problem.
Oh, interesting.
What do you think, Jared?
Yeah. I'm with you on that, John. Because the fact that there's so many VPN providers is, in my opinion, fan-freaking-tastic. The fact mm-hmm. that it's not a monopolized industry, and there are a lot of folks you can go to, but I am a parent of three now adult children. I have taught my children, my kids, how to be responsible digital citizens from the time that I put the very first device in their hands, which was at a very young age. And I can tell you unequivocally that this is not a debatable point. If you go into any middle or high school in the United States that has a wireless network, you will find kids with free VPN services on their smartphones, often multiple. And, mm-hmm. you know, I said this before, you've heard it before, but if you're not paying for it, you are the product.
Mm.
And what is going across, and these are kids. These are people who aren't even of a legal consent age in the US, and they're sharing information that's very likely being intercepted, decrypted, stored, viewed. Yeah. And they have no idea.
Yeah.
Because you know, they're not to your point, John, there's nobody doing it for them, right? There's no enforcement. And so in that case, right, that's where we see some of the negative aspects of the industry, that people are abusing this. Hey, if you use VPN, you can get around the school Wi-Fi filters. And, or if you're going out to a protest.
Could you imagine they come out and say, hey,
boy,
use our VPN because you can go to school and still get on the internet.
Their downloads would spike.
Right?
Anybody who takes that marketing campaign is going to rule that market.
You could play Quake from your phone in a study hall.
it's a good thing that these providers exist, but there are people, whether they're doing it for profit, whether they're doing it for that ad revenue, you know, or whether they're doing it because they've got an exit strategy as a company and they know they've got to hit X number of dollars in ARR before they can conceal the deal. It's when their decision shifts to say, we're going to do this because of the money, not we're going to do something that has value and then the money will follow.
Yeah.
It's a very short-sighted, limited approach to company leadership. And unfortunately, it's in the InfoSec and cybersecurity industry as well.
Well, and I think that's a really good point too, is you know, companies need to make money. And so where is the balance between saying, all right, I need to make money, but I don't want to sell out either. And I think there is a very fine line there. And what have been your experiences?
I won't name names, but like I said, I'm on LinkedIn. Look at my history. I have worked for technology companies that have seen some pretty wild success in the growth of the company because the leadership of that company said, we're going to do the right thing and the money's going to follow. I've worked for other companies that the leadership C-suite is like a revolving door because the VC firm, the investors are like, we need to recoup our returns. Let's put somebody in there and, you know, just see how much money we can squeeze out of our customer base. And those companies aren't long for the world, right? Their exit is not likely to be a happy one. And so I firmly believe you can look at who wrote the book, Good to Great. I'll just drop that here for listeners, right? Read the book, Good to Great. And then he's got a companion book where the author has analyzed successful and failed companies throughout history to identify some of the common traits of the leaders in those organizations, how they approach the market, how they approach the product. And what you'll find is creating something that has value results in revenue, which sounds ridiculous, but it's such a hard lesson to learn. And it's scary when you've got investors saying, what are you turning over this quarter? What are you putting in my pocket? People panic and people make decisions because they're not willing to stay the course or because they've invested time and effort in a product that doesn't provide the value they thought it was going to. But that's the trick, is you have to go in and, you know, you have to leave your babies on the cutting room floor for any of my film friends, right? You've got things you think are going to work. If they're not working, pull back, but do the right thing, do something that provides value, and the market should respond accordingly.
I mean, you can look at the whole market and actual solutions that the government or the DoD is using to protect their websites. And you can see a lot of the companies nowadays who are making a lot of money, but they're not actually producing revenue. They're returning money to shareholders. And not to name names, but there's definitely companies out there that are VC backed, like Jared mentioned, just to return money. They have a solution, but it's a pale in comparison, short-term band-aid.
So,
I mean, there's definitely a phone call and a few other random conversations, not so random conversations, on the limits of hardware on how to actually ensure security on what your computer actually is. And can you imagine that if there was that level of privacy that you had 10 laptops or 10 computers and it was all the same manufactured chip that you knew was okay?
So do you think that's the solution?
No. The hardware ecosystem is too diverse.
Okay. So then how do you ensure the security of the hardware and the software?
You have to... There's a few companies out there that have unique solutions to this, apart from a few I know intimately. But you need a fine, low-level solution that can recognize changes in hardware and in software and report back.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one too, John. There's a lot of supply chain security issues that we've seen, not just from an availability concern during the pandemic that shone a light on the potential risks there, but from a confidentiality and integrity standpoint, you know, depending on how many different hands these different components pass through, every one of them is it comes with the risk of an insider in one of these organizations making a change or altering that component, introducing a bit of code that wasn't supposed to be there. But to John's point, if we've got some verification component on the back end that says, okay, we've got all the pieces, we put them together, here's your tech, here's your hardware, And then we go through it with a fine tooth comb and say, is everything legit? Is everything on the up and up? And it comes back and says, yeah, you're good to go. Then you've got that trust. That's where it comes from. You can try to manage the supply chain security. There's a lot of third-party risk management, vendor management, supply chain management, security practitioners and programs and tools. There's a lot of value. Yeah, but it's not foolproof. It's trusting that on the back end, somebody's going to do this verification when in reality, they might not be. But yeah, if we can do that verification on the back end and say, all right, let's step back and take a look. Are we actually good?
Right.
Then I think you get to that point where you achieve the trust you set out to
I don't achieve. Know if either of you saw, but on the Red Hat social media channel, Red Hat has how do you mitigate insider threats?
Mm-hmm. No, I didn't see that yet.
And it's a recent post on their Instagram channel. And it's really, how would you mitigate your external and your internal threat?
Mm-hmm.
And so like we've discussed on the other podcasts, we need that sort of solution that lives autonomously in that middle layer between hardware and software and firmware that can provide this level of privacy, this level of expectation.
Yeah. And I want to expand on that just really quickly, John, because I've had a couple of articles come my way from my other privacy-minded friends about the rampant use of surveillance technology now that we've got such a large work remote workforce. There are managers who, and I'm going to call it like it is, who aren't very good at managing their teams, who insist
yeah.
that the only way that they can get the folks that work for them to do their job is if they put some kind of nanny cam software on their laptop to monitor mouse clicks and keystrokes and everything you do. And the unfortunate truth is that, yeah, there's a lot of surveillance technology at the OS level, monitoring user activities and behaviors. And so there is again, Brian, that fine line, that balance to be struck between when are we using these controls to protect people and when are they being abused by people to say, well, if I've got tech that can see all this stuff, I also want to see what YouTube videos they're watching or what podcasts they're listening to or things that they don't really need. But if you get down to that low level, if we're talking kernel level, ring zero, negative one, right, get really, really deep into the OS, you can identify and mitigate a lot of these risks, these threats, without actually putting the user's privacy at risk. So understanding that the different layers and what the technology might be monitoring or acting on at each layer is crucial when you're selecting and deploying a technology in that space.
But do you think that's actually realistic, though? Do you think companies will do that while still protecting user privacy?
I think the good ones will.
I think the good ones will. I can agree.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to put anybody on blast, but if you work for a company, I'm talking to our listeners right now. If you work for a company who says, nope, we have to monitor and surveil and invade, I would challenge you to make a decision, right? Do you want to fight the power internally or do you want to go to Indeed and do a quick search for other opportunities?
Yeah.
Because
you could look up the 1998 Department of Justice effectively taking Microsoft to court because of privacy and mandating people use Internet Explorer.
Yeah.
And what actually is in Internet Explorer, right? It's enclosed software, which is why Red Hat really shines, is that it's open source. You can look at the code if you want to. Doesn't mean you can understand what you're looking at, but you can actually look at it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a good point. Well, this is good. I mean, I really appreciate having these conversations because it gets us thinking. And I agree that, going back to what you were saying in the beginning, is there needs to be short-term action steps as well as the long-term. And so what one short-term action step do you think we need to take right now? And John and Jared, I'm assuming you both have probably a different one. So John, why don't you tell us what short-term action step that we should take right now?
to realize that 9 out of 10 companies that are compliant are still whack-a-mole. That compliance and NIST compliance mandated assessments are, they're a, you should probably pause it. I don't know that word offhand right now. Like NIST needs to recognize their, NIST itself needs to recognize compliance is not foolproof.
That's an interesting one. That's a whole podcast episode right there. I like that, John. No, my response, Brian, is geared more toward technology professionals, and my takeaway is going to be similar: is get involved. But even if privacy is not part of your job description, go out to EFF.org and engage. Look at the resources they've got published. Look at the Twitter accounts for folks who are engaged in that organization, part of it. I think the underlying, what I was saying, like the foundational next step, right? The things that we need to do today that are going to get us to where we need to be is learning and education about what could we be doing today and what resources are available for us to figure out how to make those changes. And then the flip side of that coin, right? Once you learn more and engage groups like EFF, is to bring that knowledge back into your own organization and challenge how the companies you're working with are approaching privacy and technology and some of the things that we've talked about today. Because unless one person raises the question, right, and introduces the importance of this conversation to their organization, that conversation isn't just going to spontaneously happen, folks.
Somebody's
got to make it happen. So that's my recommendation: is learn and engage.
I think by the time this podcast is posted, the event this Saturday, June 18th, which is with another colleague of mine from Project Spectrum, how to actually educate a cyber workforce. And to that end, it's how to actually educate computer ethics, which is at some point N amount of podcasts.
Oh, that's my sweet spot, John. I love talking about ethics in this space. I've actually got 2 courses on LinkedIn Learning on ethics in cybersecurity, and I want to do more. Yeah. Conversation for another day.
Yeah. I love it. Well, gentlemen, thank you. I really appreciate your time and sharing this. And again, it gets us thinking and it gets us moving in the right direction and it gets us taking action. So I really appreciate you both taking the time once again to be on the show. So John, Jared, thank you.
No, thank you, Brian. Love thank the conversation. You, Brian.
Of course.
It's very interesting.
John Aaron, founder and CEO of Aaronetics, and Jared Brennan, founder and principal consultant of Brennan Consulting. My name is Brian, and thank you so much again for joining us here on the Red Hat X podcast series. We talked about a lot today, but some more information on what we discussed, head on over to EFF.org. A lot of great resources there if you've never seen that before. Aaronetics.com. And then you can also connect with Jared over on LinkedIn at Jared Brennan. Have a wonderful day, and we will talk to you in the next episode.